Good morning, everyone. Apologies for the late start. We were downstairs having a breakfast, and when you pull together great minds to talk about this, it's really hard for us to stop. So forgive us for that. My name is Kimberly Flowers, and I'm the Director of Global Food Security here at CSIS, but I'm also the Director of the Humanitarian Agenda, which is what this conversation is a part of today. The Humanitarian Agenda is really a center-wide effort where CSIS is looking at humanitarian assistance and linking it up to large foreign policy solutions. And very specifically, we're going to be looking at access issues and what kind of policy solutions can actually help aid reach the most vulnerable. When thinking about South Sudan, we wanted to dive a little bit deeper into this from a very technical perspective, to sort of explore this and look at how, you know, whether you're a humanitarian practitioner or a humanitarian at heart, it's pretty easy to see why South Sudan is something we want to talk about. The people there have had a horrific and traumatic toll on their lives for multitudes of decades. And the U.S. government, as well as many other donors, have poured in a lot of money on this. And we want to really take a look to see what's been effective, what's not. So we've pulled together some of the best minds for that today. As someone who focuses a lot on global hunger issues, that's my area of expertise and interest. You know, when I look at South Sudan, of course, I'm thinking about that over half of the population is facing extreme food insecurity this year. Last year we talked a lot about four famines, meaning four countries that were on the brink of famine, but the fact was that only South Sudan had famine officially declared, and only in two counties, and that had been lifted after a few months. But the point is that even if it doesn't have an official famine declaration, it does not mean that the people there are not safe or nourished. It's very hard to even understand the data points when we're looking at a conflict zone. The other thing I just want to point out is when we look at humanitarian assistance, no matter where you're coming at from that lens, it's changed a lot in the last few decades. You know, today, humanitarian actors, humanitarian, you know, aid workers are predominantly working in man-made conflicts. Notice it's never woman-made conflicts, but in man-made conflicts, it's not the same as responding to a natural disasters. And so what you have in protracted humanitarian crises today is how that conflict affects the whole spectrum of assistance, from the political realities to the on-the-ground frontline negotiations. And that's some of the elements that we want to talk about today, is how you operate in that insecure environment. And for our keynote speaker today, we could not ask for a better person to really represent the role of the U.S. State Department and how it interacts in terms of humanitarian leadership, as well as the importance of the influence of career foreign service officers, particularly in the political climate that we have today. Ambassador Molly Fee has extensive experience in East Africa, the Middle East, as well as with the United Nations. Most importantly relevant to this discussion was she was the U.S. Ambassador to South Sudan from 2015 to 2017. More recently, she was the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Bureau of International Organization Affairs. Her prominent postings, it'll be long if I list them all, but let me say a few. In her public servant career, she has been the Deputy Chief of Mission in Ethiopia, the Director for Iraq at the National Security Council, and the Deputy Security Council Coordinator at the U.S. Mission to the United Nations. Ambassador Fee, the stage is yours.
All right, I have multiple microphones here. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming out to discuss this very difficult and tragic situation. And thank you to Kimberly and to CSIS and to USAID for focusing on this very important topic. I think this conversation is long overdue, and I'm delighted to have been given the opportunity to participate. I think it's important at the start, and I'm sort of surprised that I have to say this, but I do want to say this. We are all here, I think everyone, I presume, who's participating in this conversation and those who've come to talk about this problem set, because we care deeply about the people of South Sudan, who are tragic victims of this conflict for which there appears to be no end in sight. So I want to emphasize that undergirds the discussion, that everybody is looking for a way to help the situation get better. So when we talk about this important intersection of humanitarian assistance and this very difficult political situation with this protracted conflict, we are not challenging the fundamental assumption that we, as the United States, have long been the most generous country in the world in terms of humanitarian assistance, and in particular have long been generous to the people of South Sudan and remain the largest donor. So I think that's important to emphasize because we need to ask difficult questions about the role of the United States in this conflict, the role of assistance in this conflict, and is there a way that we can adjust the way we provide humanitarian assistance that means we're more effective in helping the civilians, which fundamentally would mean an end to the conflict, because that, in fact, is what is creating this humanitarian crisis. So I thought I would give you a brief anecdote of something I tried to do when I was ambassador, which I hope will set the stage for some of the problems that we're dealing with. So in 2016, when we were trying to implement the peace agreement, and we at that time had some hope that with the return of opposition leader Dr. Riek Machar, that he would be able to work with President Salva Kiir and begin to move the country forward and out of the conflict. So as he was returning, I engaged in conversations with the leadership of South Sudan and ultimately with both President Salva and with Dr. Riek about this great idea I had as a naive American. So one of the reasons South Sudan delivery of humanitarian assistance is so expensive is because they have terrible infrastructure. And so there's we have to often fly in assistance. So what we don't use is what I call God's highway, which is the White Nile, which runs through South Sudan. And so if you think about it, if you think from Juba to Bor, so from Equatoria to Jonglei, Bor is a Dinka-dominated area, Juba is in the heartland of Equatoria, and then the White Nile goes up through Unity and then enters Upper Nile. So what I suggested to these gentlemen is that WFP had a lot of assistance up at the top of the country, if you think of the northeast part of the country up near Rank, where they could bring in assistance from Khost in Sudan, and there were barges. So we could have a barge that could come down and go through Upper Nile, where there are Shilluk communities and Nuer communities, come down through Unity, predominantly Nuer, go to Bor, predominantly Dinka, and come to Juba. So if the two men could instruct their militaries to cease the attacks which had made the river, and still is, the river is impassable and because of insecurity, so we would be able to use this incredible natural highway and send a signal, they could send a signal to the country that they were ready to make peace, they were ready to move forward, and they were gonna help all of their communities. So I, of course, was really enthusiastic about this idea, talked to a lot of people, talked to the leadership. So what do you think happened with that idea? Nothing. Okay? No one even said, oh, you're a dumb idealistic American, but we get what you're trying. This is a way to do this that would be better in our system or whatever. They were not interested in using the peace agreement to create an environment where they could address the concerns of their people. There are other options we had. There were small tractors in Juba that we could have put on barges and brought up to give to communities like in Malakal, where they could have begun farming, et cetera, et cetera. So to me, that little anecdote sums up the challenge that we're dealing with. We're dealing with the leadership on both the government and the primary leader of the opposition, which is now quite fragmented, who didn't have the same concerns that everybody in this room has about how do you end this conflict and how do you help your citizens. So to me, it illustrates some of the challenges that have developed in the unique, what I think is unique to South Sudan based on the history of the conflict and the history of U.S. involvement. And I'll just run through a few of those. What you see in South Sudan is a culture of impunity. So no matter what they do, they think the West will provide aid. So they can kill humanitarian workers, they can detain them, they can extort money from primarily the West, so not exclusively the West that provides humanitarian assistance. They can prevent access, And basically, we continue to show up and continue to try and assist. There's also a very dangerous culture of dependency. And any senior US leader, whether Republican or Democratic administration, recent or a few years ago, Congress, anybody who's shown up in South Sudan has said, this situation is not sustainable. You must make peace. Please look around the world. You know, 60 to 70 million refugees and IDPs, competing conflicts. We can't sustain this level of effort. You need to begin to clean up this situation in order for us to work with you, to sustain support for this assistance. You need to do better. And the leaders of this country just look at American leadership and say, well, you've always provided us aid. You have to continue to provide us aid. So I've never seen anything like that in my career. That is literally the reaction, and it's a sincere reaction. They just presume that because we've been doing it for decades, we're gonna just continue to do it. I think a very important factor, which makes it very complicated to solve this problem, is what I call the sociological damage of the conflict. We're dealing with people who have been engaged in violent behavior and political conflict amongst themselves, a political competition amongst themselves for decades. Within this society, as you've seen, you know, civil wars tend to be the most vicious and most violent. We've seen the most horrific kind of rape. We see terrible malnutrition, terrible stunting, terrible loss of educational opportunities. So the society has really, whether it's the most sort of marginal individual or the leadership, has been profoundly affected by the decades of conflict, and it makes it much harder to work with them, much harder to move forward. And we've seen this in other conflicts, but it's particularly true in South Sudan, in my opinion, the weaponization of aid. And so that can be as simple as using aid as revenue. We're basically the largest external source of assistance to the country through our humanitarian assistance. It can be blocking your opponents from receiving assistance. It can be diverting aid to supporters. It can be using civilians, vulnerable civilians, as bait, which I've seen happen. I did some analysis with my great OFTA partner in South Sudan. We looked at OCHA data for 2015, and OCHA is the UN acronym for the Coordinating Humanitarian Assistance Body, and they try and track obstacles to delivery of assistance. And it was basically approximately 30% of the problems were from the government, 30% were from the opposition, and 30% were criminality. And that was our analysis in 2016 of the 2015 data, and I would presume those sort of rough proportions are probably still current today, although you'd have to look at the current data. But so that's what you're dealing with, a problem set. So a society where the economy is destroyed, so there's a lot of rampant criminality, of course there's no security, and then all of the actors at some point using aid in some way. So I just wanted to lay that context for you so we could open up a discussion about sort of options for the way forward. And I'd like to offer one from my perspective, which I think is the most important. I think we need to remember that we, again, as I said at the outset, we are the largest donor, and we have a responsibility, I think, to try and work with our implementing partners and with other donors to seek a collective approach to the problems of access. The government still retains primary control of the country and has the largest impact, I think. That's not to say that the opposition doesn't control certain parts of the territory and that the opposition is also tends to be somewhat splintered. But I think we need to see unity of effort, and I think it needs to come from capitals to protect the vulnerable people on the ground. And I think it can't just be from donor agencies. They have to be backed by their governments, given sort of a donor focus on humanitarian impact, which sort of complicates this discussion in the sense that there's a suggestion that if you try and do things differently, you're going to hurt outreach to civilians. So to me, that we can talk about it during the panel. I have seen myself examples of where we've unified as an international community, and we've been able to have influence. And when we don't remain unified, we become weaker and more vulnerable. So to me, that is the single greatest change we could make in terms of adapting our approach to humanitarian assistance and delivery, and that's something that we should work on. And we should say, we don't find it acceptable in trying to help vulnerable people that the people who are trying to do that are murdered. We don't find it acceptable that they are detained. I do not find it credible, which I have said to the leaders of South Sudan, that they tell me that NRC, which is the Norwegian Refugee Council, the ICRC, WFP, premier names in humanitarian assistance, also World Vision, CRS, that those people, which I've been told, are trying to enact a political agenda. And that's why they deserve to be detained and harassed. Right? That's not credible to me, and it shouldn't be credible to anybody else. So I think we need to say we need a better environment for our delivery of humanitarian assistance, and we need to do it in partnership with our other donor communities. And again, I don't think it can just be the development agencies. It needs to be the development agencies backed by their governments. So anyway, I hope that's a helpful, if not sobering, introduction. And I want to thank CSIS again for including me in this conversation, which is so very important. And let me close again by emphasizing that we have always had solidarity with the people of South Sudan. And I hope that if we can improve our effectiveness in engaging with them, we'll be able to sustain that commitment for the people of South Sudan. Thank you.
Okay, I am Deputy Director and Research Fellow here at CSIS in the Project on Prosperity and Development. Really appreciate you taking your time and coming out here to talk about this important topic. And thanks to Ambassador Fee for those excellent framing remarks. I think you posed a lot of very interesting questions. Before we get to the distinguished panel that we have before us, I wanted to make a couple points. One is that we were expecting to have Luca Kuhl join us on the panel, and unfortunately the visa gods are against him and he is stuck in Senegal right now. It's really unfortunate. I was really looking forward to having, and I think we were all looking forward to having his voice on here. So I'm gonna call an audible, a think tank audible, and make an offer to Luca to podcast him and really continue this conversation with him, because I think his voice is really critical, and I just wanted to acknowledge that. I also wanted to acknowledge our participants online, including those in South Sudan. I hope that the internet gods are playing nicely with you and that you are able to live stream this. Thank you for joining us. And we really appreciate your time as well. Lastly, I wanted to thank the U.S. Agency for International Development, who has been partnering with the humanitarian agenda led by Kimberly. This is a really unique, first of its kind, big CSIS-wide effort, and the Project on Prosperity and Development is really honored to be working with Kimberly and her team on this important event. That's enough from me. Come at this conversation as someone who lived in South Sudan, in the Equatorias, but also in Upper Nile, pre and post independence. I care very deeply, and I really appreciate how Ambassador Fee started and ended her remarks with an appreciation and I think a deep love for the people of South Sudan, and I think that is the context within which we want to have this conversation. We come to this from the humanitarian agenda is really focused on how can we get better access for humanitarian aid. There's a Most estimates put the need in South Sudan as about 60% of the population will need life-saving assistance by the end of 2018. And we're talking about this in the context of a May 8th White House aid review that was called. There was a statement by the White House that on May 8th of this year that called for a comprehensive review and said that the U.S. government is committed to saving lives, but really we have to ensure that assistance doesn't contribute to or prolong a conflict. And I think that's the that was an added impetus. We were already planning on having that, and I think that really lit a fire. And it was shortly after that we called Kate Almquist-Knopf. Did I pronounce the last name correctly? Okay, thank you. I practiced in the mirror. So Kate was our first call. Kate, she probably needs, if you're in this room, you care about South Sudan, and that's generally an assumption I'm gonna make. And if you care about South Sudan, you know of Kate and her really excellent work that she's done. She's currently the director of the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, which is an academic institution within the U.S. Department of Defense. She's been in that role since mid-2014, but has been thinking about and caring about South Sudan, Southern Sudan, Sudan since the mid-90s. And so it's with humility, I think, that we called Kate and said, Kate, we need to do something on this. We have this platform, this humanitarian agenda. South Sudan's really not getting the attention that it deserves despite this incredible humanitarian need. And there are all these access issues that we're thinking of. So Kate, thank you so much for being here. And if you could just kick us off by maybe reflecting on what the ambassador said, but also just how are you thinking about these issues of humanitarian access and generally moving the humanitarian conversation forward. You think a lot about the politics, you think about the geopolitics and the regional politics, and so if you could provide a good framework for us to continue this conversation, we'd be grateful.
Well, thank you, Errol, and thank you to CSIS for convening this forum and this discussion. I think it's critically important as we're in the fifth year of conflict now in the current iteration of civil war in South Sudan. And in fact, humanitarian conditions continue to deteriorate and to worsen. And so I think the core challenge to us all is to really reflect and to try to understand, to diagnose why is that the case. What are the drivers of the conflict that are perpetuating and deepening the crisis? And how is the response working? What's effective, and where do we find challenges and impediments to our ability to provide the life-saving assistance that's so vital to keep South Sudanese afloat until there is a political dispensation that really addresses the root causes of the violence taking place in the country. And so I guess my first point that I'd like to follow on Ambassador Fee's comments, just to say that the real objective, and I hope the focus of our conversation can be on how to achieve better humanitarian outcomes for the people of South Sudan. We're challenged by that to figure out what are the metrics for humanitarian outcomes. When we look at the macro level indicators for South Sudan, the story is pretty bad, and year after year, it gets worse. But we're challenged because our data is pretty poor, point of fact, and we need to understand why is that the case in terms of what humanitarian agencies and analysis is able to tell us about food security, about malnutrition, about mortality, about other key indicators of the conditions that people are living in South Sudan. There's a forthcoming report from the Feinstein Center that I want to give a little shout out to that hopefully will be available maybe even later this week, really looking at some of the data collection challenges that we have in South Sudan right now, and the gaps in our data, the problems with the quality of data, the politicization of data on humanitarian indicators, These are critical things for us to focus on if we're really going to understand where this very massive response that the international community, the United States in particular, has mounted through many brave individuals out on the ground delivering assistance. The metrics for our success cannot be the dollars we spend or the degree of access that we think we have. It really needs to be on the humanitarian outcome that results from that. That to me is the key. Is life getting better or is life getting worse for people in South Sudan? And there are many ways to try and pull apart that question. I think part of that is recognizing that humanitarian needs are driven by conflict. And in fact, we have an infographic on the Africa Center website that looks at the FUSE net map from October of 2013, so just prior to the outbreak of this civil war. Over time, we've updated it to show the current FUSENET projections for food insecurity in the country. Again, recognizing that the data is challenged, but progressively we go from a situation of nearly zero acute food insecurity in the country just prior to the outbreak of the conflict to a situation that most probably is widespread famine, truth be told. Across much of the country. And that's political, and that's conflict driven. And yes, there is a complex array of factors that add to that, but we need to recognize that. And I think to pick up on a point that Ambassador Fee mentioned as well, this conflict is a conflict waged against the people of South Sudan. We have numerous human rights reports that document this in grotesque and horrifying detail. This is virtually genocide. It's ethnic cleansing, it's clearing of populations, and for us to not appreciate that putting a scarce resource, any kind of assistance, into such a resource-scarce and politicized environment where the belligerents are using the civilian population as part of their military strategy, it behooves us to understand how aid is being used by those belligerents, because it is being used. And there are some great reports that are trying to document this and put it into the context, in fact, of the history of South Sudan, which has for decades, sadly, been in need of humanitarian assistance, and where we have seen belligerents use humanitarian assistance as part of their political and military strategies for controlling populations and resources. And so we have to be savvy about that and to really understand what the dynamics around the delivery of assistance is within the context of the conflict dynamics and a conflict that is being waged against the civilian population. And then finally, I'll just offer that I think all of this suggests that we really need to look at risk management and how we better deal with the trade-offs in the, attempting to reach as many people as possible with life-saving assistance. This is one of the costliest humanitarian operations on the planet. Certainly the United States has put billions and billions of dollars into this program. It's the costliest in terms of lives of humanitarian aid workers. And that means that we should be continuously challenged to see how can we make it more effective. How do we get the return that we're seeking in terms of humanitarian outcomes for the size of the need that exists and the amount of resource that we're dedicating to that? There's no perfect answers here, but it does, to me, all suggest that we really need to rethink our paradigm for delivery of humanitarian assistance, to look at all the options for how we understand the political realities of assistance inside South Sudan. I'm not arguing that we should cut assistance, just to be clear. I know that this conversation becomes fraught quickly in the context of the assistance review. It can sound like that, but the key question is, what are the outcomes we're getting for our assistance, and how do we better deal with the belligerents, the government in this case, most importantly, because of the dominant control they have over the country and because of its responsibility as the so-called government, how do we better deal with the government in our delivery of assistance for the people of South Sudan?
And I think that we wanted to talk about what are the tools in our toolbox to, you know, what are the pain points in ensuring greater humanitarian access? And I think cutting off aid, I think that that's not what this conversation is about, and I agree with you. But I think it's worth considering what some of the other tools are. What are the sticks and the carrots that are going to actually bring people to the table? And from a more historical context, are there examples of these types of, you know, you're one of the foremost global experts on Sudan and South Sudan, and so are there some examples of how this has worked in the past where this confluence of political and humanitarian access has resulted in better outcomes for people?
Well, I think, again, to echo Ambassador Fee and to her credit, during her time there, I think she exerted leadership, as the United States has done in the past. I see Ambassador Hume is in the audience with us, and I had the pleasure to work with him on both Darfur and South Sudan during the interim period. And I think we have experience when the United States, as the lead donor in this particular two countries now, says, we're not going to tolerate certain behavior and certain actions, and we put the weight of the United States behind that, we can change behavior. Mm. But that requires some toughness on our part, some difficult calls to be made, and we have to actually stand by our words if we're going to not continue to feed the culture of dependency and impunity that now I think we're seeing has come is a grand part of the problem here, that in terms of the current level of humanitarian distress in the country. So we have a responsibility as I think the donors to provide the buffer for humanitarian agencies that are working to implement assistance in very difficult circumstances and very dangerous circumstances to really play the heavy, so to speak, with the government and with the opposition and other armed actors that may be the specific cause of a problem. But if we're not unified in our positions in that regard, then the program is too large. There's too much resource there for one principled stand to take effect. If other parts of the humanitarian operation are accepting really conditions that they should never have to accept. Let me just say that from my time as USAID director in Sudan and South Sudan, and from working on this for the last 20 or so years, what the government in Juba has put upon the humanitarian community is in many ways worse than anything the government of Sudan did as we were seeking to respond to their denial of aid and access to South Sudan. Hmm. And so I just find it unfathomable that we can't stand up to this government in Juba and in a more consistent way, further to, I think, a number of the experiences that that Molly had while she was there. But it requires clarity on our part, and it requires us taking some tough positions that can be challenging in the immediate moment.
Tough positions indeed. Ambassador Fee mentioned several really prestigious humanitarian organizations in her opening remarks, and one of them being the Norwegian Refugee Council, and we're really honored to have Joel Charney here, who is the executive director of Norwegian Refugee Council USA. He comes at not only South Sudan, but the humanitarian world with an incredible wealth of experience and knowledge. Previous to this position, Joel, you were Vice President for Humanitarian Policy and Practice at Interaction, which, for those that don't know, Interaction is the premier NGO forum here in the United States. And I can't think of any better person to be on the stage right now to be representing the humanitarian implementer perspective, and so I'm sure you'll have that hat on, but also if you could put on the general, as the hat of someone who has worked in and around these issues of humanitarian access more broadly. And so we'd love your thoughts on either what they said, Kate and Ambassador Fee, but just generally how you're thinking about these issues. Yeah.
Thanks, Errol, and thanks, Kimberly, and thanks to Octave for sponsoring this. And I just appreciate being on the panel and being given this opportunity. These are tough issues. I mean, I'm here, I think, you know, on the one hand, sure, speaking for NRC, but trying to speak more broadly on behalf of the humanitarian NGO community. And there are no, I mean, I'm really wrestling, Errol, with this whole issue of how we can be more specific. And, you know, what are the three points that would make our program more effective? I think it's the right question, and honestly, I'm not sure that there's an easy answer to that. Why? Because the fundamental driver of the humanitarian challenges in South Sudan relate to political issues and a long-standing political conflict that we have no control over. And the ambassador and Kate both alluded to that. So I think the danger is, and I'm not accusing either of you of doing this, but I think the danger is that given the complete political impasse, given where we are, well, what's in our toolbox? Oh, the handy humanitarian sector into which we're pouring hundreds of millions of dollars. Let's see if we can use the humanitarian aspect of our engagement in South Sudan to further political goals that are important and legitimate. So I think the first point is, as tempting as that is, we need to kind of avoid that temptation. Okay, so we therefore, as humanitarians wanting to be more effective, we ask ourselves, well, what is the way to do that under current circumstances? And I think what we've come up with so far is inadequate, but maybe notionally some steps in the right direction. So one of them might be to be just more conscious of local realities, more present, more able to be with the people of South Sudan in a meaningful way. Now that involves taking very serious risks. South Sudan is the most dangerous country for humanitarian workers in the world, and that danger is being incurred primarily by South Sudanese and other staff from the wider Africa region. And in other words, the focus on staff security in South Sudan arose from that grotesque attack in Juba on expatriate workers. Mm. But the daily reality is it's the South Sudanese themselves who are taking the risks. So it's very easy in a way to say, let's be present, let's focus at community level, but we need to acknowledge that there are risks involved in that. Nonetheless, I think a way forward potentially is to be more local, more grounded, maybe do more cash assistance. And that was one reason we were discussing earlier, why is this operation so huge? Well, there's a massive air operation involved in flying stuff all over the country. Are there places in South Sudan where there's need, but where that kind of assistance may not be necessary? Is there a way to put cash into local markets or into local communities that therefore involves less expense and, you know, potentially a little bit less overall risk in terms of how to do the programming? The other thing, the other aspect of local, I think, is being having the external agencies, the NRC, as mentioned, CRS, Concern Worldwide, and so on, to for us to be more unified and in a constant dialogue at the community level. I'd say the national red line discussion, I will admit, has been a total failure in the sense that we say, you know, don't you dare do that. And then the government does it or the belligerents do it. And then we continue doing the same thing regardless. I think that we need to acknowledge and we need to own. But there are numerous examples at local level where the red line discussion has actually worked, where we've actually respected that red, where we've said, you've done that. I mean, the example my colleague cited when we spoke yesterday is an example last year where basically the local commander took all the vehicles that were available in a particular community, and I won't mention the agency, but you know, there's a famous photo of, you know, like a machine gun mounted on the back of an agency vehicle. Well, the agencies came together and in a unified way said, we're walking unless we get our vehicles back, and the vehicles were returned. Now, that's I think in the grand scheme of things a rather trivial example, but I think that kind of effort to work together at local level is essential. But on the, what I'm really struggling with is the bigger question of, is our work fundamentally fueling the war? Are we fueling the conflict? And, you know, perhaps you in the audience have some thoughts on this. I mean, the difficulty is, It's very easy for me representing a humanitarian organization, and I stress that on the spectrum from pure development to, you know, the ICRC and the MSFs of the world, NRC is involved much less on the development side of things than on the humanitarian. So we're not an ICRC or an MSF, but fundamentally we work in conflict settings to bring humanitarian relief. So we're on that side of the spectrum. And so therefore it's relatively easy for me in any time I'm pushed to cite the humanitarian imperative. What do you want us to do in South Sudan? You say we're fueling the conflict. Do you want us to walk away? Do you want us to cut our funding? You know, do you want us to no longer work there, potentially literally jeopardizing the lives of, in our case, thousands of people, not millions, but thousands. You know, I can always play that card. But on the other hand, we do want to be more effective and more impactful with the resources that we have. So, I mean, I think we're open to any discussion and any free advice about how to do this better in such a difficult circumstance. But again, I think what we want to avoid is an effort at a global political level or at a donor level to kind of use humanity, you know, the pain points. I don't think humanitarian organizations should be part of a pain point process. You know, I think we should be part of a process that says, how do we help the beleaguered people of Sudan better? And let's find pain points that are more political and diplomatic rather than, you know, trying to use humanitarian assistance as a way to, you know, to send a message. And we've heard a bit of that, I think, recently from this administration, notably from Ambassador Haley, that that's something that's really tough. We would push back against that kind of approach and that kind of discourse where we're literally tallying UN votes and then deciding who's going to get our assistance on that basis. If we are going to be, again, Kate, let's focus on impact and effectiveness. And if that's the conversation, I think we can have a potentially productive conversation.
And what you said something that was really interesting that we haven't heard yet, which is the when you talk about national red lines, you're really talking about something that hasn't worked and it's been toothless sort of threats or whatever you want to say. But the unified, I'm working in Jonglei State or Upper Nile or somewhere, I guess all the states are different now, but if we're working in these areas and we collectively draw a red line based on the capture of vehicles or sort of some other assistance, that actually results in better conditions that create better access. Did I hear that correctly? Is that what you were trying to
get at? No, absolutely. And there are a lot of, I want to give the specific location because I know there are a lot of experts on South Sudan in the audience. The particular example I'm citing was in Okobo. Mm-hmm. And a place where there were five or six organizations working. We were all attacked simultaneously in the same way. Like you wake up one day and whoops, your vehicles have been confiscated. That I think made it a little bit, of course, vehicles, now you're hitting us where it hurts. Mm-hmm. So I think that made it easier to act collectively. The other thing, Errol, that I think I neglected to say, and again, this came out from the conversation with my colleague yesterday, but he told me that there right now in South Sudan, in our analysis as NRC, there are only two places where we truly cannot go.
Hmm.
Those being an area outside of Wau and an area in Yambio in Western Equatoria. So I think...
But that's today.
That's what I mean. The point is that, yes, it's a shifting environment, but I think the point is that is access the fundamental problem, or is aid manipulation and the internal politicization of aid the fundamental problem? And I think our argument would be, given the overall access situation, with what's with so few pure no-go zones, you are prevented from going there. I think our argument would be, it's basically, how are you effective in an incredibly complicated operating environment, as opposed to how can we get more access? I think it's the former question that's more fundamental in South Sudan.
You and some others this morning, we had a private roundtable beforehand, and it was off the record, so I won't attribute it to anybody. But there was talk of access not being the solutions to access, and let's add access that leads to outcomes.
Sure.
as a takeaway from this conversation. But it's is the conversation about access that leads to better outcomes the same conversation as what to do about capture and diversion and manipulation of aid? Are the tools that we potentially have, are those the same tools for those, or are those the same conversations, or those separate conversations?
I think they have to be linked. It would be crazy not to link them. But I think the question is, in places where, and again, when I say we, I mean we collectively, in places that we're working, what are the pressures that we're under, and what's preventing us from relieving the suffering of people who need our assistance? And that may be an access blockage, it may be a diversion issue, it may be any number of issues, but I don't see any way to have a separate access conversation and then a separate conversation around how the aid is being utilized. Is it really getting to the people that need it in the terms that they you know? Again, the Ambassador, you started again. We'll all thank you for starting in exactly the right place. The question is how do we relieve the unbelievable suffering of the people of South Sudan? How can they have agency to solve their own problems? And that gets into something maybe I didn't emphasize enough, which is there are going to be places in South Sudan right now where there's a potential to do small-scale development work. We should absolutely be seizing those opportunities to the extent that that's possible.
Because wouldn't it be nice if we build resilience to future? I know you have, you love that word, resilience.
I love that word, it's my favorite word. But you notice it's like, it's kind of dropped off the map. I mean, resilience is so 2014. you can tell me now what the word is. I've lost track. But
well, I think this is a really nice segue into something else that I really think is critical to talk about, which is we talk about South Sudan nationally as a country. And I think, Ambassador Fee, if you could just spend a couple minutes talking about, is South Sudan, is the access and better humanitarian outcomes conversation a South Sudan-wide conversation? Or is this much more of a fractured, some things may work in some places while they don't work in other places, and we have better access in some places than other places? Can you talk a little bit about the current state of the conflict? It's a little bit of a leading question, but being a little bit more fractured rather than a sort of, I think a lot of people on the outside may think that there's one actor and there's another actor that's going against, and there's this sort of simplistic understanding of what's going on. And if you could paint us a little bit more of the complicated picture, and then maybe I'll ask Kate and Joel to comment and elaborate on how, given that fractured nature, you know, what are some things that may work in some places that don't work in other places?
Sure, but first I'd like to say that I'm sure that Joel and Kate feel this way, and I know that you feel this way too, Errol. It's really regrettable that we don't have a single Sudanese here.
No, totally.
And one of the challenges of this conflict is that I really physically hate being in the position where it appears that I care more about the plight of the people of South Sudan than other South Sudanese.
Which
and
is
I don't
not true.
Mean to
yeah.
suggest that, and I think it's so important that I want to explicitly say that on behalf of all of us. And of course, South Sudanese would be better placed to discuss their current environment and their own interactions than outsiders.
Yeah.
And so I will be limited in what I can say by the fact that I am an outsider. But what I would say is it is true in a sense that conflict has fragmented in terms of particularly the opposition. But these are communities that know how to communicate with each other, that know each other. And I think we have run a danger in our analysis in overemphasizing the conflict has fragmented. Mm. So that is definitely a fact, and I'll come back to that. But one of the challenges we also have as outsiders, with the exception of a few people in this room, and I mean that with all love and affection, we are dealing with leadership that has been in place for decades. But we all change. And I think particularly in the United States, and I have said this about my beloved State Department, we are very bad at knowledge management. And many of us are vulnerable to the history starts when I step off the plane syndrome. So we're dealing with people who get all these, you know, excited, enthusiastic, I'm going to come and help this conflict, people who get off the plane, and they just see us coming and they manipulate us and play us. So that is really a factor we have to be conscious of as we try and solve the challenge. What's different now since the collapse of the ceasefire in 2016, and Joel, to move the conversation, I just want to say I agree with you. We're never going to come up with a perfect solution. We have a lot of people who are very bright and who've tried to work this problem for a long time, and there's no immediate solution. So we're talking about improving it on the margins. But try not to go to that sort of very black and white binary, well, if we don't do it, then people will die, right? Then you're playing into their, we can do anything to these people and they'll still give us aid. So what can we do? So in July 2016, people may recall, WFP had a large warehouse in Juba. And immediately after the conflict, it was completely ransacked. And I looked up the numbers. So there were 4,600 megatons of food stolen, which is $28 million, and it could have fed 220,000 people for a month. Plus, they stole everything. They literally stole everything in the warehouse. So that was a tragic consequence of the fighting. But what very wise South Sudanese said to me later, in fact, that the SPLA took most of that food, and that their argument was that it mitigated the subsequent looting in the town of Juba, which there was still terrible looting, because they had that food which they considered the spoils of war from that point in time. So aid is part of the conflict. There are also really difficult conundrums. The ethnic cleansing that Kate referred to. So that's what's different now in 2016. So the war has spread to Equatoria. In the first part of 2014 and 2015, it was mostly in the greater Upper Nile region of the country. So we saw the destruction of Bor, again, the destruction of Malakal, the destruction in Unity State. But what happened after 2016 is it moved down into Equatoria, and it also moved into western Bahr Ghazal, into the well-established town of Wau, where there was a multi-ethnic community. And that was a major market town. So Joel, that's a challenge for the cash, because the market economy has collapsed. I mean, of course, in everything in South Sudan, there's a counterexample, but that's, I think, been a real challenge with the idea of injecting cash, because things can't get in, because the roads into the country are from Equatoria. That's been insecure, and Wau was the major anchor, you know, in that part of the country, and it's been very hard to get aid there. So I think in terms of the current situation, Joel, that's what's different now than what we saw in 2014 and 2015. And as I've been told by South Sudanese and other experts, and there are people in this room who are much smarter than I about this, but Equatoria, first of all, was a place where you could produce food. So in fact, clever development folks like Kate would buy food in Equatoria and move it throughout the country. And it was also a place where you could transit from other parts of Africa, from Kenya and Uganda, and bring in food. And that lifeline, if you will, has been severely disrupted. And that was what just to go back to what the United States was doing when we were pushing the Regional Protection Force in 2016, it was to sort of stabilize Equatoria so that you could bring in aid and assistance. So I think that's one of the things that's different. I think I'll stop there, but it's sort of that. So yeah. Now you have really the entire country engulfed in some sense of conflict, and of course it does move depending, and there was a lot of pressure by the government to go after strongholds of Dr. Machar's area, particularly in Unity, where there was the feud between Taban Dengai and Riek Machar being played out. And you mentioned Dikobo, so they were moving east towards Dikobo and Pagak to try and regain dominance, again, in areas which were traditionally held by Dr. Machar. But to me, the difference really is the loss of Equatoria and the destabilization in Wau, where there's just been horrific violence. So you get into these problems where WFP had a problem in Wau, you may recall, where some of their workers were killed, some of them were detained, and they actually said to the government, we are going to suspend assistance because we can't operate in this area until you make changes. And that was successful, ultimately. But in this very, very bitter civil war, they are accusing organizations as esteemed as NRC and WFP and ICRC of being partisan in the conflict, which is totally specious.
Now, as you probably know, I mean, our country director was PNG'd.
I know, I spent a lot of time.
That's right, in November of 2016.
Yeah.
And we never found out why, never. Right. To this day, we have. So, I mean, there's no transparency whatsoever in terms of even what the accusation might be. It's just, you leave, And to this day, there's never been, and we continue to operate there and have a new country director, but we never found out why Victor was expelled.
And I do want to just come back to your point. I mean, not having Luca on the stage or a South Sudanese representative was it was something, as Kimberly knows, from day one, we were very focused on this. And I think we decided to continue with this conversation partly because we wanted to draw attention to a conflict and sort of an issue set that's not getting enough attention in our opinion. And also, we are talking to a certain extent about U.S. and non-South Sudanese tools that can be used. And I think within that perspective, I'd love to hear, Kate, if you could talk a little bit about what some of the multilateral and regional efforts are to not just resolve the conflict, but create an environment in which more humanitarian access is a reality. I know that there's been some action in the UN Security Council, and I know there's been some regional action as well, so I would love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, thanks, Errol. I guess if I can jump into the conversation. In terms of achieving better humanitarian outcomes and better political outcomes, right? I mean, we have two very fundamental tracks that are both challenged at this point in time in terms of effect for the people of South Sudan. On the humanitarian front and the conversation we're having here, I agree, we want to keep the conversation on how to achieve the, as I said at the outset, better humanitarian outcomes, better conditions for people to live in South Sudan. We have to do that recognizing there is a political economy in which assistance very much is not just part of the picture, it's almost the whole picture, just in terms of the economic distress of South Sudan right now. And there are any number of dilemmas and conundrums that poses for how to deliver humanitarian assistance when the humanitarian operation is the only source of foreign exchange in the country. And when the private sector, such as it is in Juba, in the capital city, is controlled by the dominant group controlling the government right now. And so there are levels of complexity to the political economy that I think is fundamentally challenging, and it goes back to my point at the beginning about risk management. That means we have to have our eyes wide open, we have to have clear analysis of who's in control of what resources, what the power relationships are, who's connected to whom, and to be aware of how externally provided assistance is feeding into that, to take decisions wisely, knowing that we can't mitigate everything, but we could be a lot more cognizant of how they're using these, they're seeing these resource flows, because these stories that you both just told, just reaffirms that the actors themselves, the government and opposition, other belligerents, see aid as political. They see it political. So that's one thing. On the political process side of things, we have a whole other event on that. Which this conversation is not necessarily meant to be, but it is.
But I think they're related, right? I
mean, absolutely. And it is always a challenge to find the right balance of what is needed to move the political calculus to a better outcome. We want a resolution to the conflict and an end to the violence. And I don't think that's a rearranging of the deck chairs of the power sharing arrangement that has failed spectacularly multiple times now. So we're not on a path to resolution of the conflict. So further to Ambassador Fee's point that this conflict is not going away, we're not about to see a resolution to that. That means, even more so on the humanitarian side, that we have to be mindful of the political dynamics of the assistance that's going in, and of this massive amount of need that continues because the conflict and the violence and the political challenge is there. I think it's sadly the case that the people of South Sudan are the last consideration in terms of the current peace process and what the region has arrived at. for a variety of reasons, in terms of, again, relooking at the power sharing formula and the wealth sharing formula. I mean, it's really a competition over who can control populations, who can control land in a certain way, who controls whether assistance comes mm-hmm. in or out at this point. I see no prospect that the United States or any of the other major donors are going to put financial resources behind the current formula that's on the table today. You know, the United States has invested incredibly in South Sudan for many, many, many years, but specifically over the course of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement process, the interim period leading up to the referendum on self-determination, and you know, since independence and in 2011, and the level of resource needed now to pull South Sudan out of its crisis, not just to continue delivering humanitarian assistance at the level of need we see, is far beyond anything I think we could see in our current foreign assistance reality right now. And so that's really challenging. The United States is not going to be there, most likely, in the way that we have in the past, and the way the presumption is on parties, and the way the people of South Sudan need in terms of some kind of recovery and pathway forward. If the political reality aligns in a different way, maybe there would be some hope for some investment in reconstruction and in an economic bailout for the people of South Sudan. But but the current formula inspires no confidence for doing that. So that, I think, just puts the onus back on the humanitarian operation and back on this fundamental question of what is the diagnosis, right? What is the nature of the challenge that leads to this overall worsening of the humanitarian situation for the people of South Sudan? Where can we gain traction in humanitarian indicators? How can we build out from that? Can we preserve, you know, even bubbles of pockets where we have some effective results? How do we get better data so we know what's happening, right? What the level of need is and what the level of effect is of assistance so that we can make smarter, wiser decisions about allocation of resources. Again, being cognizant of the political lenses through which the recipients mm-hmm. and those controlling the ability to provide that assistance are looking at.
And maybe that's an opportunity for, again, in the current construct, you don't see an opportunity for U.S. leadership, but I think that the U.S. is so thoroughly invested in the success of South Sudan, and not just independence, not just the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, but continuing on. And so I'd like to end my questioning, because I do want to turn it to the audience, and I'd like to end my sort of moderation of this panel by making just a plea and a call for greater U.S. leadership on this. And I know that we're going to be at CSIS thinking a lot more about this. There are smart people in this town, in Juba, and all over the world that are thinking about this. I know Peyton at USIP and a whole bunch of other people are really putting all of their brain cells to try to make this happen. And so, again, I think this panel probably raised more questions than it answered, and that's, I think, okay. And I think the onus is on us to keep the attention on this issue set and find ways that we, the United States, can actually be a productive part of whatever the solution looks like in the future. And so with that note, I do want to turn it, we have a few minutes left, and the audience has been so patient. I will ask, I think I'm going to take two questions first, and I'll bundle them, and I'm going to ask that you state your name, and who you're representing today, and then try to make the question brief and have it end in a question mark. So we'll start with this gentleman up here. We'll get you a microphone here, 1 second. Yeah, go ahead. This gentleman's gonna have a microphone for you. Thanks for being here. Yes, sir.
Yes, my name is Gordon Boy. I'm the chargé of the Republic of South Sudan, United States.
Thank you for being
so
here.
So my question, because the discussion is very good, but there are some issues that I want to raise because Ambassador didn't talk about them. We signed MOU in 2012, where we the South Sudan government cannot charge American NGOs any fees, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that one is implemented. I think the ambassador is the witness.
Mm-hmm.
In regard to our problem with some American NGOs, there is a case here, the guy called Domingo Ruiz. I think you know that Domingo, working for Food and Agriculture Organization, and he was PNG in 2017 because he was linked with the rebels. We shared the same intelligence with U.S. intelligence, even the U.S. Embassy is aware of that. There was another case, Save World, American NGO, the same thing. So what I was trying to say to Joel is that if you need evidence, we can provide that. But we did the same thing to the U.S. government. Any American NGO suspected by our intelligence, they provide the evidence. I think, Ambassador, you are aware of this case, because this guy was also, at some point, an American embassy security agent. And later on, he worked with FAO. So the other thing is a Kobo incident. Kobo is under the rebels. I think you know that, right? So there are cases where American NGOs are involved in certain illegal activities. Whenever our intelligences have evidence, the first thing we do is we share it with American intelligences. And we did it more than five times. So this thing is not being reflected. Well, of course, for some American intelligence, they can keep them as secrets. But if, let's say, NGO community are coming out accusing our government, oh, you are doing this or doing that. Of course, we have been very transparent because we don't charge an American NGO any fee. But we have very cases where we have evidence. And if any one of you would want, in 3 days, I can supply that evidence to you. Why we PNG those NGOs? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll take one more question, and then I think we'll get some responses on that. Any other questions? Yes. Let's wait for a microphone. John's got one right there. Please stand and.
Of course, yeah. Hi, my name is Amal Abukar, and I work for CAPE Institute, which is the only research institute focused on the Horn of Africa and the Middle East. So I've been working mainly on focus on the Middle East as well as the Horn of Africa. I'm actually from Somalia. So basically my question is, facilitating of humanitarian assistance require obviously understanding with all stakeholders. And the region, last month there was a major peace talks, South Sudan held in Ethiopia. But here my question will be, has anyone been held to account for the deterioration of humanitarian situation in South Sudan? That's my question, actually.
Thank you. And I think you're also a Rotary Peace Fellow.
Yeah,
yes.
Correct.
Thank you for being here. So let's take those two questions, and if we have time, I'll get to a couple. But maybe Ambassador Fee and then Joel can respond to our colleague from the South Sudanese Embassy, and then Kate, maybe I'll ask you and to respond to the second question.
I think it's very important that folks understand that the government of South Sudan is now considering a finance bill, which would again introduce the concept of raising the fees on humanitarian workers and would also attempt to tax them. So this goes to my mind to what Kate just referred to in terms of the political economy. And that the government is desperately searching for sources of revenue, and they see the humanitarian community as the fat calf.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, although it is quite true, as the Chargé pointed out, and I thank you for reminding folks, that in 2012 the U.S. government concluded an agreement with the government of South Sudan, which we try and do in all countries where we are providing substantial humanitarian and development assistance, that due to the generosity of the American taxpayer, we don't expect the government, which is receiving that assistance, to tax us for this assistance, which is designed to address emergencies and help develop the country. Nonetheless, American implementing partners have been taxed by the government. There was a unity of purpose, which is why I'm big on collective action, to reject an initial effort in 2017 to charge each humanitarian worker $10,000.
Yeah.
That was so ridiculous that it received the support of the entire international community. So the government abandoned $10,000, but then came back with lower fees, which were still at $4,000, as Kate is reminding me, which are still, in my mind, and I think to the mind of most members of Congress, unacceptable. So one area in which we can look concretely in the near term for the international community to remain engaged is to say that we do not believe it's acceptable to tax this assistance that we're providing to help the people of South Sudan during this acute crisis.
Mm-hmm. Joel?
I mean, what do you want me to say? I mean, our country director was declared persona non grata. He was given 24 hours to leave the country. We are still based in Juba, and to this day, we've received no explanation as to why he was asked to leave. If you'd like to look into the situation, we would welcome that, but we've had no answer from the government. We try to maintain constructive relations with the authorities in Juba. We work widely in the country, including in areas that are controlled by the opposition. That's how we operate as a humanitarian agency. I mean, there's really nothing else to say.
And you operate quite effectively all over the country, in my recollection. And I also think that your guest house was right around the corner from where our guest house was, and I may or may not have used your internet sometime in Juba.
Well,
so thank you for that.
Of course, we share our internet.
But Errol, I think more importantly, the people of South Sudan know the NRC.
Yes,
the NRC has been a friend for decades to the people of South Sudan, and they, I cannot imagine, would support the idea that NRC is a political actor in any way, and that should be pressured in any way, given the kind of sacrifice and support that you provided for decades. Sure. I think that's really the important point.
Absolutely. Kate, either on that one or especially getting to our
I'll just pick up on the accountability question, because there's been far too little accountability to date. This is back to the culture of impunity point that the immense justice questions. You know, further to Ambassador Fee's point in terms of the spread of the conflict, this is truly a situation of historic significance for the people of South Sudan in terms of the level of distress that is wrought on the country and on the civilian population. And I don't think that even back into the Second Civil War of 1983 to 2005, we ever saw this level of conflict and violence so pervasive across the countryside in any one moment. Certainly in different parts of the country previously, but never as all-encompassing as it is now, and including the Equatorias, which should be a productive region for food and other resources for people of South Sudan. So.
I want to ask a follow-up question to that, Kate, about are those types of accountability mechanisms actually useful for creating greater humanitarian access? So do they have specific, explicit goals of creating better access and outcomes? And if so, are there examples that's actually been the case? And before you answer that, we're going to draw this to a close, but I would love if all the panelists could think about if you could leave the audience with one tweet length idea of how to, what's one thing that you want them to really take away from this conversation and go home? It could be a question. So just be thinking about that. But in the interim, while you're doing that, Kate, just do these things work?
I think it's important that we prioritize justice and accountability for justice and accountability. And I think one of the long lessons of conflict in South Sudan is that we have overlooked the importance of justice for grievances within communities, between communities, by the state, against the civilian population, in so many different levels and ways. This was not adequately addressed and dealt with in the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, going into the phase of independence for South Sudan, and this civil war now since 2013 has just added an immense amount of pain and of grievance for the people of South Sudan. That needs to be dealt with for its own sake. If there's ever to be, you know, the social fabric of the country is ever, you know, to come back together, and frankly, if there to be a logic for a nation state in South Sudan. That's not to question the validity of independence for South Sudan, but to say that for South Sudan to cohere across communities, and recognizing just how bitter this conflict has become with community against community and ethnic group against ethnic group, we really have to deal with justice for justice sake. Yeah, I think that can only help to enable humanitarian and economic and other social development needs for the country by doing that. But it's important to keep that prioritized. That's right.
Ambassador Fee, any last parting words of wisdom in 280 characters or less?
Don't give up. We still have influence. We still matter. The people of South Sudan still have capability. And it's worth asking these tough questions and getting to better answers.
Joel?
I just think we need to be more agile and more flexible and more community-based.
Okay.
I would say that South Sudan absolutely is a situation that can be turned around. There are political solutions to the conflict there, and there is an incredible wealth of experience and even the resource that we have dedicated right now to South Sudan that could fundamentally make a difference here. Yes, there are some regional complications and realities to that, but they're manageable. This is a solvable problem. It is. Not the situation that we have in some other complex humanitarian emergencies where we can't have a win here. And it's incumbent upon all of us to continue to strive for the policy changes that would allow us to see a fundamentally different situation for the people of South Sudan.
Thank you to everyone that joined us online, especially those that took time out of your afternoon in South Sudan to watch this and be part of this conversation. Thank you to all of you that came, and please join me in thanking our panelists.
That's a Cambodian.